Welcome to The Month End, a CPG community chat. The Month End will provide emerging CPG brands real-life knowledge into the accounting, finance, and operational world. Our guests will be key stakeholders from those same brands, as well as other key contributors to the industry, which all have vast experiences and insights that will be shared with the audience. All right, welcome to The Month End Podcast, Episode 6 with Keely Tillotson from Wild Friends. Keely, I forgot even to ask, is that how you pronounce your last name?
Very close. Tillotson.
Tillotson.
Yeah. Okay. It's hard because they're O's, but they sound like I's.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Very excited. So Wild Friends, please give us a little background of what Wild Friends is and what you sell, like where you sell, your website, and just kind of, you know, where you're at today.
Yeah. So Wild Friends is a nut and seed butter company that I started with my college roommate, best friend, co-founder, Erica, who's, you know, we're still best friends today, almost 10 years later. We started in which is probably our biggest accomplishment as a business, to be honest.
I was just going to say, you guys are still best friends.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And we started way back in college, just for fun at the University of Oregon. We were both college athletes and we loved peanut butter. I mean, we kind of lived off peanut butter, especially since we were both vegetarian at the time. And, you know, peanut butter is the college student food. So we just loved it. And we were kind of unusual at the time because we also were always seeking out all these natural foods. So we would go off campus and go to the natural co-op and buy our, you know, jar of crunchy Adams peanut butter every week. And then one day we ran out and had read a recipe about how to make your own peanut butter with a food processor, which luckily Erica had just gotten for Christmas, and we made our own. And I think there was some spark there where, you know, we saw the potential of making different flavors, different varieties of nut butter, and started to just give it away to our friends. And like a lot of food businesses, you know, you get great feedback from your friends and they want to, you know, they want to buy it from you. And that kind of makes you think, huh, maybe I have a business on my hands. So 10 years later, I mean, every year the company has been a different company. And it's grown and changed and evolved, and we've learned a ton. But we're available all over the country now in classic creamy varieties. And then we also have like a chocolate hazelnut butter and a honey sunflower butter and some varieties that fill other niches for folks. And we sell online at wildfriendsfoods.com. That's one of our fastest growing segments of our business. But we also sell at Sprouts and all these other natural chains across the country. We also sell in some select Walmarts and some Targets. So you can find us in some conventional grocery too.
Awesome. Well, that's a great background. I've alluded to in prior conversations, a lot of our kind of target market for this podcast are basically emerging CPG brands that may be 0 to 2 or 3 years old is all. And since you've been around for nearly a decade, I think we can get a lot of really good experience and kind of some thought process in terms of different iterations of your business or your decisions you made from a financial and accounting perspective or a supply chain procurement perspective, inventory management perspective. So I think that's going to be kind of a big theme here. And really to highlight and illustrate to, you know, the listeners of this podcast that like, hey, you don't need to make the 100% right decision in years one or two, or the right decision, right in quotation marks. You need to make the decisions that you have with the data you have at that time, you know, resources from time, from money, from funding, et cetera. So basically, how about we start out with kind of number one in terms of sales channels? So you said your fastest growing sales channel now is your website, but kind of, did you start with a website? Clearly a website now with Shopify and Amazon in 2020 is different to what was going on in 2011. So kind of where did you start selling and kind of where do you kind of currently at, or why have you made the decision to move maybe more into direct to consumer versus not?
Yeah. So folks that are just getting, especially a food or any CPG business started, the most important thing from our perspective is just to see if people want it, right? And so the first thing we did actually, and you're right, the platforms look so different. A visual side by side would be hilarious. But we went on like one of these free website makers and made a little website for Eugene, Oregon only. This is just where we went to college. And we were like, we'll deliver to you for free, which is crazy. We were just like, yeah, we'll deliver peanut butter to you for free. We're like, we like to bike around Eugene. Like, and we would get maybe 3 or 4 orders a day, and because we got in the campus paper, you know, like in local Eugenians reading it would be like, oh, college girls making peanut butter. This is funny. And we would deliver peanut butter to them. But we got so much feedback in those early days. We ended up doing a farmer's market early on. This is all before we went to retail. And, you know, over the course of those 3 or 4 months. Like, we probably changed our flavors multiple times. Like, we did so many things that once you get on a retail shelf are, it's almost a crazy how hard it is to do things at retail. If you want to change your product, it's like a barcode change, which sounds like easy, change the label, but it's months of drama. It's painful. Like, retailers make things very difficult. It's set up so small businesses will have difficulty thriving, not on purpose, but it's just a really old school industry. So we started on e-com. I think that's been really great to always have that channel, because it's, we're the buyer and we control, you know, we get the direct feedback. When somebody buys your product at retail and they taste it and they don't like it, that you'll never hear from them. You don't know why, and you don't know what they bought instead. And there's just so much on e-com that's a great way to learn about your customer early on. And then even as you get much bigger, because when you get a lot bigger, you have a lot of preconceived notions about your business that may or may not be true. So e-com is a great way to test it.
Gotcha. So, you know, you're selling on e-com through your website using Shopify, right?
Yes. We now use Shopify. When we first started, it was like, you know, whatever, an email, you know, whatever. And I think that's like, don't sweat the systems at the beginning. Just get something up. It doesn't even have to look good. You should see what our website looked like. It's just like, get it up. Don't waste time being like, I'm going to spend a year researching Shopify versus WooCommerce or whatever. It's just not worth the early time, you know?
Yeah, it's the whole like minimal viable product. Get out in front of people, get feedback, iterate, change, take it, you know, moving forward. Don't perfect it right away. So now in terms of, you're still in direct to consumer, you know, on your website, but you're also in like through the big distributors, right?
Yep. Now we did eventually get into retail about a year later, and we sell through UNFI, we sell through KeHE, you know, these big distributors that everybody has their list of complaints about, and we do too. But there's no way we could sell at all the retailers we sell at without, you know, kind of a big distributor selling to them. So yeah, we've been selling through UNFI and KeHE for a while. We've learned a lot about how to work with those customers, and we've also lost a ton of money from not knowing at the beginning. So there's some things you should just jump 2 feet in on, like, yeah, sell on e-com because you control it. And then other things like UNFI and KeHE, where I'd say, yeah, like talk to a lot of people and learn as much as you can, because some early mistakes with those big, big distributors could, you know, use up all the cash you have. That those could be, you know, major big decisions, major big issues for you down the line.
Yeah, I've definitely seen some clients of ours that somehow through their contract negotiations with UNFI or KeHE selected like the box of like, hey, for every story we get like a free fill or several free fills or whatever it is. And all of a sudden they get into thousands of stores nationally, and you just literally just calculate the amount of money, inventory, the deduction dollar, like it, and it's crippling. Like there's no way to get back without like a lifesaver. So you really need to ensure that, number one, you're aligned with somebody who understands that and walks you through that. Clearly there's, you know, brokers and brand, you know, commission folks that can help with that. But also making sure you're kind of tracking that and reviewing that aspect. So from the different sales channels you're in, distribution, direct, Shopify, like how do you analyze specific, what metrics do you look at within those sales channels for success? Clearly, you know, top line revenue and things like that, but gross profit, you know, advertising or ROI, like how do you analyze that data to say like, where should we be spending our resources, time, energy, money? And are we getting what we want as part of that?
Yeah. I mean, for us, when we've evolved on this, so we've kind of gone through multiple iterations of what we've been focused on. And, you know, initially it was all about, we just want to get this product in as many people's hands as possible, but we weren't, you know, VC funded out of the gates. We had like, you know, a Kickstarter. And so we were like, we got to make money, at the end of the day. And honestly, we strayed from that when we took on venture capital, because we were like, okay, we just got to grow. And, you know, folks that invest in you, like they may or may not care if you're making money. So like some of the metrics like margin, you know, okay, well, let's launch new innovation and the margin doesn't really matter. You know, it's like easy to lose sight of that. And a lesson I've had is, especially when you're running your own business, is, you know, profitability matters in CPG, and it's easy. It's not always talked about. I think it's like a really unglamorous side of the business. So in the last like 3 or 4 years, our most successful years have been because we've refocused on profits and profitability on every channel. So on e-com, it's easy to get lost and like, oh my gosh, it's growing so fast. It's confusing. Like, oh, I don't really know how much I spend on Amazon PicPak. I don't really know how much. And it's easy to just not want to do that like make a little econ P&L, but it matters a lot because really quickly you can realize, okay, I can only afford to spend this much per order on advertising. If I'm spending more than that, it's not really a sustainable business. It's like, so we really care about only a few things. It's like, what's our top line? What's our spend, our promotional spend to get a product off the shelf? So what's our true, what are we truly getting paid? Are we spending 15% to market this product, whether it's at a retailer or on Amazon or on our website? And then what's our profit after cost of goods? And like this year we've been super focused on margin. It's been the only thing we've really cared about. Like sales, some sales, e-com's grown organically, but we're just like, we care about our product margin because everywhere we sell that product, we see the benefit of margin that helps us on every channel. So let's put our energy there.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's some great information. Clearly a lot of, it's interesting because you have to start out like, how do people get to learn about my product or, you know about my brand and taste it, right? So you're promoting it really heavily. You're giving away a ton of samples. You're, you know, doing free fills and slotting fees and distribution, and you're spending all this money up front, but people understanding it as I think, you know, in terms of me seeing kind of the last decade of the different clients we've had and the different phases they're in is like understanding your different phases of your business and saying, hey, maybe the first 2-3 years is just growing top line, getting the brand out there to get awareness, get feedback, and ensuring that you're accounting for things properly and having sufficient cash to do that. But also you can change that over time and say, all right, now it's time to focus on profitability or margin analysis, you know, amongst the channels, but just understanding that and having a game plan. Don't just go out there without a game plan, you know, whether it's 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, in order to kind of go and execute against that. And I think, you know, growing top line revenue, and clearly we're accountants, so we're focused on, hey, within each sales channel, what is your gross revenue? What is your contribution margin? Your overall operating profit within that channel after, you know, basically your cost of advertising, the pick pack fees, credit card fees, cost of product, et cetera. Because you need to understand if you're sustainable. And I think that's the key word here is, right? You've been here a decade, so you guys have sustained this far. And a lot of people can go out, raise money, do this cool thing. But then all of a sudden in year three, year four, they're struggling and they're not understanding those numbers and because they're not sustainable, and then it's just going to be a painful process continually until you actually cut back, understand your margins, and be able to run a sustainable business. Because really, that's where clearly sustainability is like a long term impact here, right? So that's what you need to do as a business owner.
One thing I've noticed, or one thing I advise companies to do at retail, is it's really easy. It's easier than you think to get a bunch of buyers to say, "Sure, yeah, I'll take your product," right? So you can spend the whole first year being like, I'm killing it. I'm getting all these first orders. Yeah, I have to pay free fills, but they'll pay themselves back. I did the math, right? Well, you probably did the math with your velocity too high because everybody does, like how fast your product's going to turn. Everything turns slower than you think. Like I remember going into a grocery store and being like, I bet like 20 of these jars leave the shelf every day. Look at all the people in here, right? But like we're happy in our nut butter aisle if we turn like 3 jars a week in a store. That's like, you're doing great, right? Like, so just, you know, and then 6 jars in a really good store is like amazing. So, you know, you're probably doing your math too optimistically. And then you don't know what it's going to take to turn. So I always tell people, like, it's really unglamorous and it feels so slow, but like get into your local chain, you know, 12 or 10 or 5 stores, and then just let the product be there for a year and like learn how fast it turns when you're promoting it, learn how fast it turns when you demo it. Like, meanwhile, you can do e-com, maybe you get into some other stores, but like if you go like ham the first year, you might realize by the time you turn your mind to profitability that it's just not possible because you're not ever going to turn fast enough to make the kind of money you have to make. Like, and then that's really painful because you spent all this money, you have bills, you know, you're stuck being like, ah, what do I do? Maybe you need to increase your price by $1, but it's too hard to do it in all these stores now. So doing like little retail tests, as painful and slow as it feels when all these companies around you are like blowing up, like that will help you be sustainable for the long term. And you'll be a lot happier in 5 years than those other companies that just blew up without testing their assumptions.
And I think that, I mean, that's a super like awesome point of feedback because it's interesting because, you know, when you're running a business, taking it from here to here, you can go straight up, right? Or you can kind of do it smart, get feedback smart, move on, make different decisions, iterate, yada, yada, right? So when you're like saying, I'm going to go from 0 to 100, The problem is a lot of times you don't have the infrastructure in place to support that, whether the infrastructure is the number of team members, the amount of money, the relationship with your co-packers or your in-house manufacturer to support the amount of inventory you need to sell, right? So like literally understanding that aspect and doing some little test markets can help you get a lot of those things under your belt and maybe launching new SKUs and seeing how they do or things like that as well. And getting those relationships maybe with your, you know, your co-mans or however you're procuring your inventory to support kind of the growth that you expect moving forward. So, I think that that's, you know, really good information there. So from that aspect, I want to move into basically what I just chatted about: supply chain, procurement, inventory management. So like, give us a little update on kind of where you're at now, but also where you started. Has it changed over time? I'm sure it has. Just kind of like lay it all out in terms of how you've basically, you know, outside of from your, you know, your campus dorm room, like, you know, with your partner's food processor, where is it? I'm sure it's evolved since then, but maybe not.
Yeah, they were definitely evolved from the single food processor illegally making peanut butter in our apartment. So, I mean, we knew right away the type of product we have. Well, we did spend like a day or two researching peanut butter roasters on Alibaba.com and realized like, we are not, this is not us. Peanut butter is actually a really machinery intensive product. It's not like granola where you just need like a commercial oven and you got it in like a Hobart mixer. Like our product requires like a huge roaster to get good roasting. It's a lot of food safety issues with nuts and peanuts that you have to navigate. And then grinding is like, actually grinders are like insanely huge, powerful machines to grind something as hard as like an almond. And then you need a jarring machine and sealing. And so we knew like, that's not us. We need a co-packer. And I mean, we didn't know anything about business or food. So our experience to find a co-packer was like, my dad worked for a Coca-Cola, like he worked for Honest Tea within the Coca-Cola system. So we were like, dad, can you like email your friends and be like, do you know about peanut butter makers? Like we didn't even know the word co-packer, you know? Mm-hmm. And we ended up finding this tiny little co-packer in the Fresno, California area. So tiny that we were adding our ingredients. Eric and I were physically working on the line, our first production, adding our, I don't even know if that's should be allowed, but like adding our physical ingredients with paint mixers and 40 gallon buckets because they didn't have a way to add additional ingredients. And that was what made our product unique. And then manually putting them into a filler. So very like the minimum viable co-packer was like our first run. Mm-hmm. Since then we've, you know, we make nut butters in 10, 20, 30,000 pound runs. So we're able to work with much bigger, more professionalized co-packers. And recently we actually, the biggest change in our business, it's margin matters so much because it's like the way I was describing it to a team member the other day, who's, you know, we're teaching open book financials, was like, it's basically like you get your paycheck or you have your top line paycheck and then your taxes are taken out of it. And for us, that's promotional spend. And then, you know, more taxes are taken out and that's the cost of goods. And at the end of the day, that's how much money you have to spend on like rent and food and like all these things. And the better margin you have, like the less you pay that co-packer for COGS, the more money you have to spend on everything else and still end up profitable. And it sounds super basic, but I think it's once we put math into business settings, it cut people's minds go blank because it doesn't feel as reasonable as the numbers are so much bigger. It just makes people's mind feel freak out a little bit as opposed to their personal finances. So you know, margin's been so important to us, and so we actually ended up partnering with a co-packer at the beginning of this year in the sense that they've invested in our company. They are now part owners. We have a very symbiotic relationship. They've taken over our they now manage doing like our bookkeeping and a lot of our sort of rote operations activities because they already have that capability within their company. So we've been able to integrate operations into our business in a way that's transformed our company. Like we used to be on the very, like we were barely breaking even if we were breaking even. And we knew that something had to change in our margin structure for us to continue to be sustainable and then be able to invest and grow because we were just stalling out. And that's made a huge difference. They've been so amazing to work with. They're a huge part of our team. It's so nice to get on the phone with a co-packer and talk about a problem and solve it together rather than being like, okay, how am I going to negotiate this price down? And like, how am I going to get them to do what I want and prioritize me? Those relationships can turn toxic when they become so transactional. So anything you can do with your co-packer to feel more symbiotic, even if it's not dramatic as of taking an investment, like goes such a long way for a small business.
Yeah. And it's clearly it's hard to do up front as well if you have zero leverage or, you know, you're only doing so much volume, right? So again, this is something that can take, you know, years and to create a relationship like that to, in order to be able to kind of create that kind of really symbiotic partnership. But anything you can do with that to help out definitely helps out. In terms of now that where you're at now, where you have this partnership, I'm sure you're kind of overall kind of purchasing plan or inventory purchase or buying of inventory is much more proactive now than maybe it used to be because of your resources at hand. Is that right?
Well, there's just two ways to co-pack, and we used to always own our own ingredients, buy our own ingredients. We own them. We send them to the co-packer, or they're already there depending on what the ingredient is. And so we're paying for everything upfront, even but like 60 days before it becomes a finished good or longer if it's packaging. Yep. And now with our newer co-packer and with most big co-packers we've worked with, they buy all the ingredients and they sell us a finished good. That's such a game changer when it comes to cash flow. It's so nice not to own any peanuts. I just own peanut butter. I know how to sell peanut butter. I can't sell peanuts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that at the beginning, if a co-packer had been like, which one do you want to do? I would have been like, I don't know. They sound the same because you're not thinking in terms of cash flow. So definitely recommend that structure if you can make it happen for yourself, because it makes you feel so much lighter knowing that if, you know, worst case scenario in a cash crunch, you could sell a few pallets of nut butter to a reseller, you know, and be able to fill your cash gap. And you know, we still do our own internal demand planning. I think as a small company, like there's certain things I know I will never outsource. Like it's like, oh crap, this buyer called me. They need this much now. I need to plug it into my spreadsheet. Like some things will always be within our core business. Like we're always going to be scrambling about something, you know, because we're a scrappy company. But when it comes to like, okay, let's plan a reasonable amount of peanuts for the year and get a contract in place. Like these are things that our co-packer can now manage, that we used to have all those relationships and manage all of our raw ingredients too. It's been great to take that off our plate.
Yeah, I think, that's really good information as well. I mean, you know, the clients that we work with are clearly, you know, you have the range, right? You have the turnkey co-packer. That's exactly the relationship that you have where it's like, look, I'm buying a finished product. They're handling the sourcing, the paying of that. It's a much more simpler model to execute from your perspective, right? And then the other end, in-house manufacturing, where you're sourcing everything and actually creating the product. And then in the middle, right, the co-packing or co-manufacture relationship where you're literally sourcing the raw material, sending it to them, right? So as part of that, a couple of things, clearly the cash cycle you mentioned, right? Like from a cash cycle, just so everybody's clear, it's basically when the money goes out your door and when you expect that money basically to come back in for the products you're creating. So the whole goal of that as a small business or any business is minimizing that as much as possible, right? So if you're basically buying a product, a finished product, and they're sourcing the materials and you have terms of maybe net 30, and then you can sell those products within 30 or 60 days and then get paid sooner versus later, it's a much better where it's a couple months cash cycle versus 5 or 6 months. And those number of months that you have literally impact small businesses. You could go out of business or have to take on basically high interest debt in order to support your operations, which messes that up.
I used to be so confused when people would be like, yeah, this $4 million company went bankrupt. I'm like, how? They're a big company. And there's no better way to learn about the difference between revenue and cash than running a small business, because you can be doing awesome on one side and just an absolute stress hole on the other side.
Especially an inventory-based business, right? Because there's a lot more complexity comes in. And then the other thing kind of about the turnkey relationship is that the inventory complexity and managing where you own inventory and how much inventory you own becomes a huge just undermining task, right? So if you're a company, you're buying peanuts, you're buying packaging, you're buying stickers, you're buying different flavors, etc. And then you have to send it to your co-packer. And then once it's done there, then you sell on Amazon so it's at the Amazon warehouse. This is you maybe sell some at your office that you have. You maybe have a couple 3PL relationships. Next thing you know, you have like 15 places where inventory is.
Yes.
So if you're a $1 million company and you have two or three people on your team managing this, like it's just a pain to understand and really to kind of manage it without leveraging technology. And so what we see with a lot of our clients is literally like, you know, once they come to work with us and we get more of an inventory kind of visibility and understanding of their inventory and work with them on, hey, let's get a monthly inventory count in place so we can do it. There's constant flows and ebbs and adjustments, or we think it's a timing issue, but we don't know. And it's just this back and forth lack of clarity that really impacts you running your business. And it's, at the end of the day, a time suck. So, you know, basically from a small business, and you've been around for a decade, so you're not even like, you know, in year one, year two, year three, like anything you can do to simplify the basically inventory or supply chain, simplify kind of some of the infrastructural things behind the scenes, so you can just focus on growing your brand, getting feedback from your customers, talking to your customers, enhancing your SKUs or your product lines. And then this, all this other stuff can kind of take care of itself. And then you can kind of make different decisions moving forward. But a lot of people, I think, go from, well, I want to like save, you know, an extra 2 points on margin. It's like, dude, you're going to waste your amount of time and energy just from a cash cycle standpoint, and then overseeing that whole process.
You can't over optimize. And I also, you can't underestimate, like, people aren't machines. So, and I've seen this happen at not just, you know, our company, but also lots of companies we've worked with where it's like, oh, if this isn't going to improve margin, it will, we'll make it happen. But like any project you put on someone's plate, that means they can't do something else. So it's like, is this worth my operations manager's time to switch warehouses and like upend his entire finance system for 2 points? Maybe not right now. Let's set that one aside. You know, it's, it's putting the human capital into your decision-making too, I think matters a lot, way more than I think initially business owners think, because they think everybody wants to work around the clock like they do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from my end, it's always like, hey, what are really the finite resources that you have to run a business or any type, anything you do in life, right? The finite resources are time, talent, and money, right? So how do you optimize and create the most efficient situation to help you take where you want your business to go? That's really good information. A couple of things. You said you are doing open book financials. Give us a little background of that and kind of why you made that decision.
Yeah. So, the other day somebody said to me like, oh, you don't want too many bosses in your company, right? Or something like that. And I was like, I actually do. I want everyone in my company to be a boss, not in the sense that they all want to sit in their office and tell other people what to do, but I want everybody to be able to make good decisions on their own. You know, we're a small team. We have like 3 full-time people now and we outsource a lot. So everybody needs to be able to like make decisions without calling me, you know? And I think it's really, really, and also I believe a lot in developing people when they work for you. I mean, that's, even if Wild Friends disappeared tomorrow, I've had 10 years of amazing experience. I've learned so much and I want everyone that works here to feel that way. If they're not going to stay here forever, you know, maybe they will, but it's unlikely. So if they leave or when they leave, I want them to be like, oh, I learned so much there. What a great experience. So for me, like the best business experience you can have is being able to look at a P&L and balance sheet. That's great even if you never work on it again and you just want to invest in a stock, like you want to go see how that business is performing, or you want to understand when somebody says like, oh, they went bankrupt. You want to understand why, what that means, you know, they ran out of cash and that's, this is where that lives. And so it's just important to me. Everybody cares about the performance of the business and they can put it into numbers. So I've often had employees come into our board meetings. Like I'm just naturally, Eric and I are both very transparent people. We're not secret keepers. We're not hierarchical. So I want everyone to know about the health of the business. And it's not hard. Like I hated math so much and hated it in high school. Like my worst grade I got was pre-calc. Like I just never liked math. It's not hard math and people get really blocked about numbers. So to me, it's such a win if I can get like my marketing manager to be like, oh man, our margin went up 2 points. And like, she can see that just from looking at the P&L. Like that's so cool. And I think it's really empowering for people. So I think it's great for the business. And I think it's great for people to understand their financials of the business they work in.
Yeah, definitely kudos to you on that. I mean, you know, it's, you come across a bunch of different personnel across, you know, the industry or wherever. Right. And if somebody can kind of explain, like I always kind of get pushed, you know, like blindsided a bit if somebody's like, oh yeah, but what's my contribution margin? You're like, all right, let's have a conversation.
Yes,
versus, like, yeah. You know, versus every month explaining the same types of things. So I think kind of going with that of you, you know, training your team members, not even your business partners, but your employees basically of what to do really helps them. And I think that's a big part of just running a business is you need to take the ownership in this and understand your numbers to really help yourself make really good decisions. And then on top of that, if you want to move, you know, in the future to provide for your employees to make good decisions, they need that relevant information at their fingertips in a timely manner.
One quick tactical tip I'd give to people wanting to teach financials is I think a mistake I made early on is, oh, every month we'll look at this for a couple hours together. What's worked way better than that for me is with employees who have no basis in P&L or business financials is I've done a thing called Finance Week, where I spend like an hour on it. I call it Finance Camp, but 1 hour on it every day for 5 days. And you just go through a different section every day and you ask questions and you give a tiny bit of homework, just like look at this and write down your questions. And that sticks so much better because you have 5 days straight of just revisiting versus like, oh yeah, now it's the monthly meeting where they tell me a bunch of numbers that I'm not going to remember because I'm too busy to spend time on it. So That's just my quick tactical tip because I got frustrated initially teaching, I think just teaching the wrong way.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot.
No, I think, if you teach somebody like literally today, then 30 days later, like they forget everything.
No, and I forget stuff like that. I mean, think about how you learn, right? It's like, it's not going to be
intensive. You need it like,
continue. You got to just like pack it in. Yeah.
Definitely. So good. Well, I think there's a ton of great information so far. So I want to kind of wrap this up and I kind of want to touch base on what we do with all of our interviews is just basically one do and one don't. So Keely, you've already told us a lot of great information. So what would be for a company who's just starting out or a business owner 1 or 2 or 3 years in, like what is one do for them to definitely, you know, do?
Yeah, I'd say just do always work to become better at delegating. It's so hard for business owners. I struggle with it. I mean, that's why I want people at work for me to be so smart and like well-educated in the world of P&Ls and stuff, because I have a hard time delegating. I'm like, I want to delegate to people who know this business, right? And so it's a two-way street. Like you got to learn to delegate and you got to learn to trust people. And I think it's work to become a better delegator and a better manager and to give things away. So I'd say that's just something you got to work on. It's not just going to come to you. You got to be like, okay, what am I delegating this week so I can work on other things? Mm-hmm. And I realize that's a privileged thing to say, because when you first start, you might have no one to delegate to, and that's okay, but you will. And when you do, it's a good thing to be thinking about. But at the same time, like from a don't perspective, you know, the early mistakes I made were overanalyzing decision-making and trying to get consensus from everybody, trying to get everyone to understand where I was coming from, trying to get all the information and just wasting time. And like at some point as an entrepreneur, like you got to make fast decisions. No one decision is going to be the make or break, but you have to make a decision and you have to be okay with some people not being happy with it. And you have to be okay with being like, look, this is the decision I made. It's my company. Let's move on. And I think striking that balance between you have to explain yourself and you have to get people on board and to see your vision, but you have to make the call. It's your company. Mm-hmm. And I think especially as you grow and you get board members, you're like, well, this board member is telling me I should really think about, you know, exporting channel. And I guess maybe I should, because they're really smart. They have a lot of money. Like it's your company, that board member, they'll come and go. Mm-hmm. Like you're going to have to live with your decisions. So you have to make the call. And I think building that confidence takes time, but bake it till you make it. Cause you know, you'll look back and be really proud that you made the decision that you knew in your gut, like trust your gut.
I think those are great, you know, insights. You know, delegation, clearly it comes in when you even if you don't have anybody, like you were saying at the start of your business, it's identifying what are the first things you want to delegate, because their time sucks, right? So it's the whole idea of, you know, what opportunity cost, right? Of like, hey, what should I really focus on versus not? And who can I come in to do that? So I think that's a great idea. And then, you know, the second point from a don't, I think at the end of the day, like running accountfully, like with where I'm at, like I make the best decisions when I have the best data at hand and have some kind of conviction and trust and understanding in that information. So I think with that, you know, faking it till you make it or whatever, get as much information as you can and then make a decision, move on, go and execute. And if you mess up, just say, hey, I messed up, made the wrong decision. Let's move on and do it. I mean, we're all humans. We make mistakes, you know, and even that.
And that part's so powerful as a leader, like being able to say to the people you work with, they're going to trust you so much more. It doesn't make any sense, but if you can say to people you worked with, hey, you know, the last decision I made, it was totally wrong, super wrong. I messed up. Mm-hmm. The next time they're actually going to trust you more, because they're like, Brad will own his mistakes. And mm-hmm. I've noticed, I just see so many leaders feel like they have to make just the perfect decision and then cover it up if it's not perfect.
Correct. Correct. Just do it. And when you know it's not a good decision, just say it was a mistake. And then you figure out, like, and tell people why you did it. Hey, I did it because the information I had was this, or I thought it was a good deal and I didn't. Let's go back and, you know, move forward in a different manner or whatever. And I mean, everybody makes mistakes, so it's all good. So, Keeley, I really appreciate your time on all this. As we kind of roll out, you know, you already said up front, like, you sell on your website, what, wildfriendsfood.com, an array of nut butters, almond, collagen blends, hazelnut, peanut, organic sunflower, nut and seed blends, multi-packs.
All the nut butters you could hope for, but I have to say, like, I have to give a special shout out to our classic creamy peanut butter. It is the best peanut butter in the world. I just, like, even if you're like, I don't care about your chocolate coconut peanut butter, if you're just a classic peanut butter person, I don't think you'll be disappointed. Awesome. I eat it every day. It's one of my favorite foods still 10 years in.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And, do you guys have anything upcoming on new flavors or anything in the horizon?
We do. We have a couple new products that are launching just on e-com next year. So keep an eye out. And our newsletter is not invasive. It doesn't spam you. And we always send, like, good sales. So I recommend, if you want to, like, keep up with us, follow us on social. But if you're not a social person, get on our newsletter. We send out special deals. Feel first to hear about new products. It's, you get recipes. It's a fun place to be.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Keeley, I really appreciate your time, and I'm hopeful that everybody who listened to this takes some of your kind of value bombs or, you know, information you've laid out to heart and go out and, you know, run their own business in the way that they want to. So once again, Keeley Tillotson.
Yeah, you got it.
All right. From Wild Friends on episode 6 of the month end. Thanks for your time, Keeley. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.